This is Jack Curtis, director of the film The Flesh Eaters. If you can't stand the sight of flesh being stripped from a human body, please leave the room.
There will be a 10-second countdown. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
There's something inside me! It's eating its way out!
These things want flesh, any kind of flesh. And once they sense it, they'll eat their way through anything that comes between them and their meat.
No one can escape the Flesh Eaters.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be necessary. Possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, the man behind the Forgotten Horrors books and the comics from the gone world. And we'll be talking more about those in a little bit. But for this podcast, we've got another request. And I got this at the Windy City Pulp and Paperback Convention, Michael.
Yeah.
And this was a guy who does some really nice work, Stephen Hafner. And I've known Stephen. We've been doing those conventions together for a while. He has Hafner Press, which is a pulp reprint house, and does just wonderful, very high-quality reprints of pulp stories, mostly. Henry Kuttner, Frederick Brown, Edmund Hamilton, names that, you know, people who are into that thing know. And I can really speak to the quality of his work. Well, Stephen came over to my table while I was at the Windy City Pulp and Paperback Convention in Chicago, and he said, I listen to the Forgotten Horrors podcasts, and I would like to hear you guys, see what you guys would say about the Flesh Eaters.
Jack Curtis's picture,
and a lot of us, the comic book crossover guys, know it as Arnold Drake's picture, right?
And my favorite comic book writer before Denny O'Neill and Steve Gerber.
Was that Arnold Drake?
Arnold Drake, man. Mm-hmm. He was one of those guys. It was like the anonymity only made you more curious to see who this guy was, because Arnold Drake was writing some of the really more gutsy and edgy comic book stories during that period, and he never got a byline for it.
Now, we talk about the late 60s?
We're talking about the early 60s.
Early 60s.
Into the late 60s. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, like, the Doom Patrol.
Right.
Which was a really queasy
mm-hmm.
quartet of superheroes
right.
who didn't want to be super.
That's right.
In other words, their powers were given them by life-threatening conditions. Arnold ended up co-creating and writing one of the more provocative DC costumed characters, Deadman.
Right, that was the Neil Adams doing.
With Neil Adams,
right.
and Carmine Infantino,
mm-hmm.
and those comic book stories of, yeah, there was no way in hell that the fans of Drake's comic books even knew who he was. Likewise, no indication that the Flesh Eaters might have a screenplay by one of the more popular anonymous comic book writers.
Right. I think, did he not also have something to do with Teen Titans?
He did, to an extent.
Yeah.
But that was generally under a different editorship. Drake contributed innumerable, untraceable plot points and tangents and arcs for the DC Comics superheroes. I mean, you see him, you see his influence showing up across the board. Heavy influence on Bob Kaniger, especially on, I would say, the Metal Men comic books. Heavy influence upon Julius Schwartz, who really didn't work that closely with Drake, but who obviously folded a lot of that influence into Schwartz's revamp of, say, for example, Superman.
When
Schwartz took over the editing of Superman during the early 70s, you saw a lot of, like, that the byline says O'Neill, Denny O'Neill, but the tone of this story sounds like Arnold Drake. And so you get that, and when Drake would rarely get turned loose on a piece like The Flesh Eaters in 1964, you could pretty well be guaranteed that, number one, freed from the restraints of the Comics Code censorship machine, and then given a forum that was, it wasn't free of Motion Picture Association censorship, but it was, in its day, it was kind of an underground film.
Well, it was, and I've noticed in the print that I saw, there was some very brief partial nudity in it, and I'm not sure if that, obviously that must have been for art house engagements or something, because even in 64 in mainstream cinema, you couldn't really be doing that, right?
No, the new freedom hadn't kicked in. Even in the smaller studios. But the content of nudity, some of it involving concentration camp.
Exactly.
Torture.
Although that doesn't really look like concentration camp footage. It looks like it was shot in somebody's living room.
It was shot for the film, but it is representative of the central character, the bad guy as protagonist.
The Martin Kosleck character.
Martin Kosleck and his background as a Nazi war criminal.
But did they not just sort of hang a Nazi flag up in somebody's house and then went through that? I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
I don't think they actually bothered to get any authentic stock.
Right, exactly. So what would that be used for? Would that be used when it was played art houses and stuff?
Depending on the venue, a lot of the drive-ins were more permissive. The art houses really weren't that accepting of a picture of this pedigree, but they played it where they could play it, and I even saw some flashes of nudity in a late night television appearance once.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they would show one print to the censors, and then they'd get the approval, and then they'd sneak the more permissive print into distribution.
Well, and I guess this is about the same time also that Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs are making the drive-in circuit as well, which also had some versions of that had a little bit of nudity, but plenty of gore.
Well, the Friedman Lewis Blood Feast, etc. There, kind of like Ornette Coleman, it was like they seemed so easy to imitate that they inspired a lot of really bad imitators.
Right.
But they also inspired some more gifted and qualified filmmakers, like Curtis and his picture, The Flesh Eaters.
Mm-hmm. Well,
coming within a year of Blood Feast, and coming almost simultaneously with Friedman and Lewis's 2000 Maniacs.
Mm-hmm. Well, like our friends Friedman and Lewis, they also came out of, I think, Arnold Drake, with his limited work in the medium, came out of the skin flicks, the exploitation films, because the only other credit I find for him is a science fiction film from 1963, called 50,000 BC, parentheses, Before Clothing.
Before Clothing.
Yeah, and it's a time travel story with the henpecked husband who travels back in time and sees, you know, naked women. And Immoral Mr. Tease, I guess, was still 4 years later, had some sort of a hold on that sort of thing. But I've never seen it. I don't know if a print exists or not, but he did come out of that. And then you also think that the editor of this picture, of Flesh Eaters, is Radley Metzger.
Yeah.
who Dave Friedman, you'll recall, always said was the class act of pornography, you know,
right.
doing the opening of Mr. Beethoven and all of those films. And he was the edit, the film editor. So there are some real skin flick connections, sort of disreputable connections. In
Definitely disreputable. And, of course, the most disreputable of all was the payola cheerleader, Forry Ackerman, who put such heavy hype on this in his magazine. That's like, you got to know this isn't journalism. This is commerce.
Now, did he have one of those? Did he have one of those people as a client?
Ackerman, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He and his clients usually were ad hoc, specific situation. Ackerman never met a conflict of interest he didn't like.
Right, and we should say he was an agent as well at the time.
An agent as well. So mm-hmm. it's like he straddled that fence pretty, I guess you could say gracefully, but there was a lot of ethical lapsing in his coverage of pictures like this in magazines like Famous Monsters.
I wonder which of the participants was Forry's client.
It's reasonable to assume Jack Curtis.
Yes, okay. All right.
Of
yeah.
course, and Curtis had, he had a career as both producer and director.
Right.
I think The Flesh Eaters was his only production as producer-director.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote fairly extensively and and often in the adults-only
mm-hmm.
field. But he did appear as a small parts and voiceover actor in a number of, you know, not that many, but a number of legitimate feature films.
Well, for those who haven't seen the picture, we should probably give a quick synopsis. And it involves a lot of people who are just not very pleasant. The whole film seems askew from the very beginning, you know, when we have Rita Morley, the actress who is portraying a drunken movie star, and her handler, Barbara Wilkin, who's trying to sober up and get her to a location.
Right.
And enlists a pilot played by Byron Sanders, who, by the way, I read in one, when I was doing research for this, I read in one source that Byron Sanders was the model for Salvador Dali's Crucifixion. Did you ever hear that?
No, I didn't know that.
There's the 2 degrees of separation from Salvador Dali and the Flesh Eaters. Anyway, they get in the storm. They have to go down on this island, and it's being run by the island is the overlord is Martin Kosleck, who is well remembered from his Universal days. Gosh, what, Frozen, Ghost, and House of Horrors, mostly, however, for playing Joseph Goebbels. In the mid 40s, because
being a German Jew, Kosleck mm-hmm. in Hollywood was a natural to caricature and not only depict but also often ridicule the Nazis.
Right, right.
And so he was a great second string villain.
He absolutely was. And this is he's the first string villain here in one of his last performances. I know he showed up in some TV things maybe after that, but
mm-hmm.
but I remember this is certainly I think his last Nazi portrayal, isn't it?
Pretty much to my knowledge.
Yeah.
Although of course he continued to play Germanic character.
Right. So
the last time I saw him was in a guest on, I think it was a Sanford and Son.
Oh, really?
Episode. And that would have been well into the 1970s. But,
sure.
You know, he'd crop up on Night Gallery. He'd mm-hmm. crop up on Banachek. He'd crop up on, I think, Love American Style,
I think. And maybe didn't he do a Batman? Of course, that would be, he did Batman, I think, if I'm not mistaken. He was a scientist on one of the Batmans,
Yes, indeed. You're right. Batman in the I think, the second season.
Yeah, I believe that's right. So he was, you know, he was around, but he was also, he was the one that gave it gravitas, I guess. And he's doing these experiments as an unregenerate Nazi, as it turns out, on this island, involving these organisms that strip the flesh from the bones of any living thing.
Yeah, but, it's a great takeoff on the most dangerous game.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And a lot more original than merely a takeoff.
Yes. Well, I haven't seen, and also as far as the special effects go, there's a combination of things, but one of them, if I'm not mistaken, some of the special effects are emulsion scratches, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, there's tampering with the emulsion on the physical film.
Well, they actually scratched, would it be the negative or on the prints, or how would they have done that? Were they just scratched it and made it look like something was eating the...
It would have been fairly delicate etching on a master print. They wouldn't do that to the negative, of course, unless
right.
they had a dupe negative.
Right.
But the effect is and of course the film is charging through the projector at 24 frames per second, so it looks pretty fast and furious. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then toward the end, we won't spoil it for anybody, but there's a big flesh eater that shows up, and you know, the thing about this picture that strikes me, Michael, is there's an overall sense of not only doom, but sort of sleaze. Do you get that feeling from watching it?
Well, the pedigree is sleazy by definition.
Right.
That does not take anything away from the artistry at work.
No,
there.
No.
It amazes me that they could take a simple point of inspiration, The Most Dangerous Game, alter it from sportsmanship to mad scientist, and then turning it into something so thoroughly original and striking that it seems self-evident that this one little, sometimes disparaged film, turned out to be the prototype for one of the most popular situation comedies in broadcast television.
Are you talking about Gilligan's Island?
Yep.
Really? I would not draw a line from Flesh Eaters to Gilligan's Island.
You've got the basic prototypes.
Right. Well, you
right
do. You have the actress, don't you?
Right, the actress.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
You've got the good girl stereotype.
The Marianne stereotype.
Right. Uh-huh. You've got the goofy Gilligan type.
Which is the beatnik, right?
Yeah, played by Ray Tudor.
Played by Ray Tudor, who, why did he never show up in any other films?
He was good.
He was good. He was really good. I told them love was the only weapon, but they wouldn't listen. Some of his lines are just terrific, but he only shows up, I think he has a small role in, Five the Hard Way or something.
Five the Hard
much,
Way, yeah.
Much later on. But, you know, I never thought about that. So that's the Gilligan character. And then the skipper would be, I suppose, Martin Kosleck be the skipper, or would he be the rich guy?
He would be more the rich guy.
Okay.
Byron Sanders fits the captain.
Okay. All right.
It's a funny thing, and I'm sure there was no acknowledgement ever made.
No, one wouldn't think so. No. I'm sure that.
But it seems so obvious.
I never thought of that until you just mentioned it now. And of course, all of those actors in it, all the principals are what they did was take TV actors. You know, Rita Morley did it. I didn't realize until I got to looking at her credits. She was really kind of ingrained in the soaps in the 60s and 50s.
Yeah.
Edge of Night and Secret Storm. And Byron Sanders was too. And,
right.
and Barbara Wilkin was on episodic TV. And so they all knew what they were doing. It's just, it has a look that is just kind of sleazy and unnerving, which really actually works in the film's favor.
It looks like a picture that, though immensely appealing to kids, thanks to Ackerman's magazine,
right.
It's not the kind of picture that your parents would have wanted you to see.
No, no. And I remember I kept, you know, to tell you what a big nerd kid I was, but when I was in junior high and high school, I kept a scrapbook of all the monster movie ads that would come out in the Tulsa World and Tulsa Tribune. And mm-hmm. they had an ad, and you may remember it. It was a little sort of postage stamp-sized teaser. And it was something like the Flesh Eaters are coming, or watch for the Flesh Eaters. And it mm-hmm. started with a little dot. And as the week progressed, the week before the film started, it would have these little sort of lightning bolt style rays coming out of it, growing bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Until we got to the opening day of the film. Who distributed? Was the distributor, as I recall, was not a major distributor, right?
No, that was, what was the name of that distributor?
I'm just wondering if they were people who also distributed Skinflix, which would maybe indicate, why it would have maybe had a little bit of that nudity and played some art theaters or something. But I don't
know. The production company was called Vulcan.
Vulcan, yeah.
The original distributor, and there were others later on in the 60s, the original distributor was, yes, of course, Cinema Distributors of America.
Yes, of course it was. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah,
there's the usual suspects.
That's right. Round them up. But they must have gotten some pretty good penetration into the market, because I recall them playing several theaters in Tulsa in kind of a block, not a block booking, but in kind of a saturation booking situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And my uncle played it at one of his big interstate houses as a new release.
Well, I have to tell you, well, first of all, would we recommend this picture to our listeners?
I would not hesitate to recommend The Flesh Eaters.
I wouldn't either, and I think Koslek is very good in it. The characters are not sympathetic.
No, very, not an admirable lot at all.
No, even the pilot seems to have his own issues, and mm-hmm. Rita Morley's character, you almost like her for a while, and then the next scene she'll be just sort of wacky, which of course is exactly, true to form. I mean, that's what she would be in real life probably, is that sort mm-hmm. of back and forth mm-hmm. character. Now, did you ever hear that Jack Curtis's wife went on a quiz show and won like $72,000 on the quiz show High Low, and that's what helped finance the movie?
Wouldn't surprise me. I hadn't thought about High Low in many years.
I know, but she apparently was on High Low and did pretty well. And also, the reason, it was filmed in, 62 and not out till 64, that a hurricane in New York destroyed the sets. And it took them a long time to rebuild, and that's why the 62-64 thing happened?
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense. So they technically would have been ahead of Friedman and Lewis.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking.
The invention of the so-called gore film.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. And that is, I believe you could call that a gore film, could you not?
Naturally.
Especially toward the end. I mean, and the stuff, when it's on, I can't remember whose leg it gets on, but Jiminy. Oh, Omar. Mm-hmm. My Lord, Omar's death as the beatnik is a pretty, pretty gory death.
Yeah. That's something that would never have happened to Gilligan.
That's exactly right. Well, I have to tell you kind of a story that we do get off on tangents from time to time. I had an aunt who named Marion Woolley, M-A-R-I-O-N Woolley, and I've never been able to find her filmography. She appeared in a few films. She's told me about them, and I have never found her filmography, but she always told me that she was in a film called The Lives and Loves of Goebbels, of Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, mm-hmm. with Martin Koslek as Goebbels.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, the story has it that she was from St. Paul. And the story has it that while she was out in Hollywood, the film came to St. Paul, and all of her friends showed up. And every time a blonde woman would show up, they would say, "Now, is that Marion? Is that Marion?" And as it turned out, she'd ended up on the cutting room floor. But this has been a family thing, and I finally, this Martin Koslek, gave me the opportunity to research this a little bit. And I think the film that was called The Lives and Life and Loves of Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, The Life and mm-hmm. Loves of Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, was a monogram picture from 1944, ended up being called Enemy of Women.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you know that picture?
And I
do. It's Paul Andor, not Kostlek at all, who was actually, Wolfgang Zelzer, I believe was his name.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Cincinnati guy, but he played that. And you see, my aunt met and married my Uncle Stan, who was a gate guard at Monogram, working for Trim Car.
Yeah,
so this would have all made sense. So I wish she was still alive so I could tell her we finally were able to do the research and find out it was Paul Andor and not Martin Kostlek. But she always swore she was in a film with Martin Kostlek. And it is amazing. And, you know, he really, like you say, a second-string villain, but like George Zucco, sometimes those second-string villains deserve to be celebrated a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see him playing backup villain to Basil Rathbone
right.
and the Mad Doctor.
Right.
Things like that. You see him as the chief villain, say, in, Strange Holiday with Claude
mm-hmm.
Rains.
Mm-hmm.
Pictures like that, and you think, gosh, this guy should have been at the, you know, he should have been in the leading ranks as opposed to the backup guy roles.
Yeah.
Although he always made more of his parts than had been written for him.
Right.
And when he got a chance to shine, even in a little picture like House of Horrors,
when he's running Rondo Hatton through his paces, making him kill the art critics.
Right.
It's a wonderful picture. I have one more question to ask you about Arnold Drake's dialogue. How do you feel about the dialogue in the picture?
Very natural.
It is. It's sometimes it strikes me as being, you know, what's the term, too clever by half?
It's awfully clever, but it sounds like things these characters would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right.
I suspect he wrote over the top like that because of the comic book background.
Sure. That's what I was kind of getting to, yeah.
But his comic book stories had much more right for the circumstances dialogue than most others. You consider the insipid writing that was going on in the Superman comic books of that
mm-hmm.
same period.
Mm-hmm.
Drake's stuff was like hard-boiled pulp dialogue.
Right, right.
And I kept thinking, gosh, why don't they let this guy write Superman?
Right.
And it's like, you know, any story that starts off one day in Metropolis, you pretty well know is going to be
right.
like pablum with a side order of Jell-O. But the funny thing about Drake was he had a career. It was a steady career. He created memorable characters. And when occasionally he got the chance to translate into film, why didn't this guy make more movies?
Right, right. Yeah. And that's a very good question. I've got to believe that Flesh Eaters made some money, you know?
Well, it certainly played theatrically into the 60s.
Yes, it did, yeah.
Into the late 60s.
Yeah.
I caught it on a reissue in what? College, which we're doing about 1968 or 9.
Right, right. And it's fairly easy to find. I think the one that Joey and I watched, our producer Joey Hambrick and I watched a couple of weeks ago, had the alleged Nazi footage excised and put on at the end. So you can see it, and there's not much to it, actually. And they made it.
No.
I will say this. They made it sort of, I don't know if this was the original way that it looked, but they made it look sort of dupey and stuff, so it seemed a little bit forbidden. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's how it was actually when it was integrated into the footage and the prints it was integrated into or not. But it's
right.
It's certainly worth a look, and we would recommend that you watch it. And, Michael, I think we need to plug. You have been protein lately, and you're getting some stuff out. Why don't you? Why don't you tell the folks now? We got to the hype portion of the show, and we'd like to talk about a couple of your new pieces. What have you done?
Well, we're actually in the studio on the 1st of June.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure this will be heard somewhat later.
Right.
But today is the publication day for Forgotten Horrors Volume 10.
Excellent.
And that, of course, nobody has missed anything. You and I are still working on Forgotten Horrors Volume 9.
But that's
I
right.
figured since I had everything in the can on for Volume 10, let's just get this thing out. And it's the first book on which I have shared a byline with Van Cliburn.
Probably be the last one, too, won't it?
Probably the last.
That's what I was thinking. Probably Van Cliburn's first credit on a low-budget horror movie book, too.
Right, uh-huh. Exactly.
Can you explain why that happened?
It all stems from this is a collection of pieces done originally for magazines and film festival program books and this, that, and the other that have never been collected together before. And one of the elements is a little film festival booklet or program guide that Van Cliburn and I put together for a film festival during the, which one was it, 2001 Cliburn Piano Competition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And nice guy to work with. I had to get subversive because he will know we can't have any horror movies,
right?
And no R-rated pictures. So we made a few compromises, but I still sneaked in the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T.
And that, if that's not horror, I don't know what is.
Right.
Good.
And so it all comes together. It's, gosh, about a 360-page whopper.
Wonderful.
Just approved the final proof this afternoon, and there it goes.
Good, good. That's wonderful. We've just had the Twilight Avenger Returns come out, and that reprints the first four books that we had come out. Terry Tidwell and I had come out from Eternity Comics on the West Coast during the, of course, black and white boom of the 80s. And they're very, very much structured like B pictures. In fact, one of the new features that we have in that graphic novel is I have gone through and I've cast the different stories with B picture actors who I would have liked, if they ever became movies, if they become movies in the 30s, who I would like to have seen them seen play those parts.
Yeah. And, lovely books.
Well, thank you very much. And that's out from Pulp 2.0 Press out in Los Angeles.
Did you get the crossover between the Avenger and the Prowler?
We are going to have that in the fourth, because that came out in the fifth issue, so we're going to have it in the next collection. Absolutely.
Splendid.
We will. Yeah, I've got that frame somewhere, of course.
Right, of course.
Yeah, and so we have done that, and I am busy. It's turned into kind of almost a mini book because you asked me to do a piece on the Beach Party films for Forgotten Horrors number 9, and mm-hmm. I've taken on that, and all of a sudden it has just consumed me. And so once I get that done, I'm sure I may be the holdup on number 9. But
we're taking our time and doing it right.
We're sure having some fun with it. I'll tell you what, I got to see Monster from the Surf again for the first time, and thanks to our producer Joey Hambrick, I got to see mm-hmm. Monster from the Surf again for the first time since I was a kid. And also dug up some stuff that Frank Sinatra Jr. had to say about it.
Oh, lovely.
So it's all good. And so when we do these podcasts, we of course, thank you for listening. We appreciate it. We love doing them. And we hope then that you will perhaps think about supporting us by buying a book or two. God knows they're out there, aren't they?
I would say they are, and the volume keeps on getting more voluminous.
It does. That's exactly right. Well, Michael, we'll reconvene shortly. I don't know. We've got a couple of maybe surprises coming up next in our next two, a couple of pretty obscure things. But we want to thank again Stephen Hafner of Hafner Press for suggesting that we talk about the Flesh Eaters on this Forgotten Horrors podcast. Thank you, Stephen. And Michael, thank you.
An excellent thought.
All right.